copied your argument in our last case, number 10-5301, United States versus Martin.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. My name is Robert Biddle, and I'm counsel to Ms. Martin. And also with respect to the third argument today, I'll be arguing it for the other two defendants on the appeal who join in that issue, defendants Goodwin and Bynum. The issues before the court on this appeal, the three issues, are about deadlines. They're about whether a defendant received proper notice of the deadlines that applied to their forfeiture claim, whether they complied with those deadlines, whether the second issue is whether the government complied with the deadlines imposed on it once forfeiture claims were filed, and thirdly, whether the court and the government complied with the deadlines in Rule 32.2 and the statute in terms of the forfeiture orders and the sentencing at the end of the case. We contend that either under the first two issues or the third issue, either separately or together, that the funds in question, approximately $700,000, should be returned to the defendant and with respect to the third claim, the defendants, plural, because each of the additional defendants have claims as well with respect to their money. Before I get into the specifics of the argument, I would like to offer the court one additional document. In the government's brief, footnote 19, the government states that the notice letter, which is at issue on our first point, that is to say the letter that was sent to Ms. Martin, they note that the customs form letter has since been revised to provide further clarity. Now, the government does not discuss how that letter has been revised or provide a copy of it. I do have a copy of a letter, a sample letter with the name of the recipient and the item seized redacted, and I'd like to hand that up to the court. Because
I don't actually see it at this stage. Okay. But presumably it's a matter of public record, so it's worthwhile looking at it if they can.
I can be writing it in. Before I move on, let me just say that the letter's been revised in a way consistent with Ms. Martin's position in this case. In other words, Ms. Martin's position is this.
Is this in the record?
What? The
revision. The fact that it was revised. And I think the fact that
the
it
government,
was revised consistent with the position of the argument sort of goes both ways. That it was revised to clarify that that always was the law or it's making a change.
I understand this is a two-edged sword. But the government put a footnote in its brief stating the customs form letter has since been revised to provide more clarity. That's footnote 19 on page 28.
Principally, as I say, this is a matter of public record. I mean, of course, it's worthwhile looking at it if it will in the case, right?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't know that it would be available to the court other than my handing up a copy of it.
Well, if it's not available, then you should have put it in as evidence below.
Well.
If it is available,
I didn't get the letter till 2011, and after the government's brief was filed.
28J provides you some relief if you look at that and see whether or not it fits properly in there.
Well, after the argument, I'll submit it.
Right.
Let me return, though, to the key facts. Defendant Martin's property was seized in the course of the investigation, which the court just heard about and addressed in the prior argument. A notice letter was provided to her, providing her with certain options to respond to the seizure of her property. Through counsel, a offer in compromise was made to the Customs Service. And the Customs Service, with respect to some of the property, denied the offer in compromise. Immediately, through counsel, Ms. Martin filed timely claims with respect to all the property that had been seized. Now, this occurred some months after the offer and compromise had been made, but within the time limits that were set forth in the notice, because the notice said that upon filing an offer and compromise, the forfeiture process would be tolled, delayed, while Customs considered the offer and compromise, which they did. Once they denied the offer in compromise, defendant filed the claims. That then began a 90-day period for the government to do one of three things, and this is laid out in 18 U.S.C. section 1983A. They had three options. They could either return the property in that 90-day period, they could file a civil asset forfeiture complaint against the property, or they could file a criminal indictment with a notice of forfeiture in it. And this "and" part is very important, they could hold the property, continue to hold the property, pursuant to either a restraining order or a seizure warrant. Those were the two options. Those were the three options within the 90-day period. In Ms. Martin's case, they didn't do any of those three things completely within the 90-day period. They did not return the property. They did not file a civil asset forfeiture complaint against the property. They did name the property. They did identify it in a criminal indictment, but they did not get a seizure warrant or a restraining order on the property, which is the other half of what they were obligated to do. Having 90 days pass, in fact, 2 months beyond the 90-day deadline, through counsel, the defendant filed a motion for return of property, relying on Section 1983, which says that if the government allows these deadlines to go past, that without taking the steps that are required, the property shall be returned. And it asked the district court to order the return of the property. The statute specifically states the government shall return the property. The district court heard the motion and made two findings which are subject to review on appeal by this court. The first was that the initial claims that Ms. Martin filed were untimely. And we discussed that extensively in the brief. We contend that under the language of the notice and the discretion that is allowed by customs, that the claims were timely filed, and they should not have been denied or dismissed by the district court or found invalid on that basis. As to the second point, the district court found that the government did not need to return the property, although the statute stated the government shall return the property. Because, the district court said, the government had, after the 90-day period had expired, had gotten a seizure warrant or a restraining order on the property. There's no question that they did get this order. The legal question for this court is whether the government was obligated to get that order within 90 days. Defense contends under the Berman case, which is a district court of Maryland case, that they had to act within the 90-day period, and they did not so act. We contend the district court's ruling on the factual issue of the timeliness of the claims is clearly erroneous. A fair reading of the statute, a fair reading of the notice, commonsensical reading of the notice, the specific language in the notice that says upon filing an offer in compromise, a claim can be filed at any time, that Ms. Martin acted timely to file her claims after the Customs Service said, no, we're not going to compromise.
It seems to me that you're arguing for a tougher standard of review than you have to by arguing clear error. It seems to me that it's a question of interpretation of the statute that could argue for a more generous standard of review to you.
I think it's a mixed question of law and fact, and I agree with the court. It's sort of like in the Fourth Amendment context where the court is applying
what the district court found, it seemed to me was more of a question of interpreting
right.
The contract. It's just an observation.
That is part of our argument, is that the district court, with respect to the timeliness of the claims being filed, misunderstood the statute and found that the statute required Customs to tell a claimant, file your claim within 35 days. And that's not what the statute says. The statute says an agency like Customs has must give a claimant at least 35 days to file a claim, but doesn't put any ceiling on that. It could be 35 days. It could be 35 weeks, frankly, under the statute. It's just the statute says you, the administrative agency, can't require a claim to be filed quicker than 35 days.
In what specifically is HAFRA bind the government in a criminal forfeiture context to the 90 days we have?
Well, Your Honor, 983 A2B, I'm sorry, A3B says across the board in speaking about criminal or civil forfeiture, if the government doesn't do one of the three things that I described, the government shall promptly release the property. So CAFRA stuck its foot in, if you will, into criminal forfeiture. And it's in Title 18, which obviously is a criminal section of the U.S. Code. So when they refer to the government's possession of the property being measured by the applicable criminal forfeiture statute, it's talking about the means by which the property can be held, that is to say, a seizure order or a restraining order or things of that nature. It does not take away from the 90-day deadline. And that's where we disagree with the district court as well. It said the reference to criminal forfeiture in 983B2C.
But it also goes on to say that if the court doesn't do those things within 90 days, it shall promptly release the property, as you have pointed out.
Correct.
And may not take any further action to affect the civil forfeiture of such property.
Correct. So it's, and the district court agreed the government can never seek the civil forfeiture of this property.
Correct.
What we argue here is that the court did not enforce the provision in the statute which says the government shall promptly release the property. Right.
How much time is left?
I've got a 2 minutes left.
But no, not now. Then, how much time expired when the government didn't give you back the property? It wasn't prompt.
Well,
in other words, there's no. You're familiar with the new Supreme Court law about jurisdiction and not jurisdiction and so forth in time limits.
Yes, the government cited to DOLA.
Yes. So what I'm trying to do is put you in your argument in light of all that new case law.
And I think it was about 60 days.
Well, it was factually, absolutely. It was they were 60 days beyond the 90-day timeline. So this
and
was
when did you ask for it?
About the 60th to 65th day. And, Your Honor, here, Dolan was a restitution case. And the court was concerned in that case about third-party victims losing out because the government missed the deadline. Forfeiture is different. The government keeps those funds. They can release them later, but there's a very complicated. I'm sorry? They can, in theory. That's correct. But it's not like restitution where the government's actually acting for the, acting on behalf of the victims directly. Your Honors, could I have a few more minutes and take away from my rebuttal time?
Yes.
Okay. I would like to take a few more minutes because I'm almost out to address the third point, which is the point common to all three defendants. Yes, ma'am.
What relief would you get for that?
The court would order the return of Ms. Martin's funds.
But the government could take the, but could the government could seize the property for use in the. You're saying that the government would be forever barred, not just in civil forfeiture, but also from using the evidence in criminal trial, because that would have to be, that's the logical consequence of your argument.
Yes, that's
correct. That can't be the argument.
Well,
wouldn't you say that the government had to give it back to you, but then they had to file a criminal forfeiture action? That, you, there's nothing that gives, it goes as far as that, is there?
I'm asking the court to read that into the statute.
And they did file a criminal forfeiture action.
They did.
That's the problem.
I understand.
What you're asking, it seems to me, is for us to do something about that 60 days when it seems, as you have explained, that the government didn't have any business keeping it.
Correct.
But what would that relief be? She gets it back for 60 days, and then they get to take it back when they file a...
Your Honor, I understand the court's struggle with this. I think that by analogy, we've got the exclusionary rule remedies under the Fourth Amendment.
Another case said yes, then I don't think we're going back.
Right.
I'm going to stay my order, waiting for the government to come up with a criminal court.
That is a procedural option that a court can consider, but it allows an opportunity for it, the return of the property to take place.
Well, no.
Well, in that case, it had been stayed. I understand.
So it stayed as it could have been done. There's nothing in this record that says that the government wouldn't have done.
It's been done in other cases. The question is whether CAFRA sanctions that or not.
But it goes back to my question, what relief would you be entitled to for that 60 days?
Your Honor, it's not in our briefs, but certainly there's interest that accumulates on these funds when they're being held. That's an issue that comes up in forfeiture. Basically, the district court washed its hands and said that there's a theoretical problem here, but we are not going to find that really there's any remedy for what occurred. And we contend that the simplest remedy is to order return of the property. Understand the court's resistance. But I'd like to address that. And I realize I'm cutting into my rebuttal time. But the third point is a very important point, and it is the one which has the most case law in support of it, Your Honor. There are at least three decisions, Crother, C-R-U-T-H-E-R, King, and Petrie, which are in our brief, which if the court follows any one of those cases, the court should find that the funds should be returned in this case because of the failing to enter timely orders of forfeiture at the back end of the case. And let me explain. The defendants were convicted. The jury did not hear anything about forfeiture by agreement of the parties. The court conducted two forfeiture hearings before sentencing, did not enter any preliminary order of forfeiture at or before sentencing. In fact, made no mention at the sentencing of forfeiture. The judgment and commitments were filed approximately 3 to 4 weeks after sentencing.
Is your argument that defendants were not on notice of forfeiture?
No, it is not, Your Honor.
I don't think that the record.
No, I don't think, Your Honor. This is not merely a notice provision.
No. Is it a notice? But is that your argument? You don't make that argument. Right.
No, I do not, Your
Honor. You concede that they were in those.
Yes, and part of that is that the rule 32.2, either version of it, directs that you can't seek forfeiture unless there's notice in the indictment. There's no question that the defendants were aware of it. The question is, what is the purpose of the rule, and what are the provisions of the rule that require action by the government?
Well, they not only were on notice of the government to seek forfeiture, but they were on notice of what the forfeiture order was going to be. There was large discussion about it, right?
Well, they were on notice. I mean, it's akin to, Your Honor, if I walked into a clerk's office and said, you know, I'm going to appeal, but I'm not filing my notice of appeal.
And
in this case, Judge Titus said,
we know that appeals are different from the Supreme Court.
I understand, Your Honor, but here the question is, under the rules and the case law, was the government and the court required to obtain a preliminary order of forfeiture before or at sentencing?
And you waited, what, 3 years?
We did wait a few years. I was not involved with the case. I understand. But nonetheless, that doesn't excuse the delay in the government not obtaining or the court entering a preliminary order of forfeiture at or before sentencing. The cases, the government, in fact, is asking for more of an extension of law than the defense is with respect to count three, argument three, because in the Aramay case, which Your Honor heard, is an unpublished decision, and the First Circuit case, Posey, those were both cases where defendants through counsel at sentencing said, we consent to sentencing to forfeiture being addressed later. And they waived the applicable provisions of Rule 32.2.
But what, and what is your response to, or what prevents the district court from amending the judgment?
Well, here's
which
the,
is what the, which is exactly what the court did in Dennis.
Right, but here's the problem, Your Honor. The rule with Rule 32.2 is that it just allows clerical changes. It doesn't allow a substantive change in the sentence. And here, they're talking about, I think the specific language is, the rule is that a clerical error involves a failure to accurately record a statement or action by the court or one of the parties. That rule works where a order is entered before sentencing but doesn't get attached to the judgment.
But you understand why I'm asking, because you cite Bennett for the proposition that a preliminary order of forfeiture entered after sentence is a nullity, but that's exactly how the court, the Third Circuit dealt with the problem.
With
allowing the district court to amend the
judgment. Yes, but I believe in Bennett, Your Honor, the preliminary order of forfeiture was entered prior to sentence. The cases relied on by the government, with the exception of Aramay and the First Circuit case in Posey, all involve preliminary orders of forfeiture entered after sentence.
Okay, we've given you some minutes.
You have, thank you. And, appreciate it. Thank you, Your Honor.
2 minutes for the rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
There's no question that the government violated the letter of Section 983A3A by not remitting the property promptly after the 90-day deadline had expired. But as Judge Duncan noted, the question is, what is the sanction for that violation?
So you're not. So you're not arguing. I wasn't terribly impressed with your time for this argument. You were saying that you had to rely on the notice, and it was unequivocal, but it seemed to me that the notice clearly kind of, well, clearly incorporated the form as well.
When you I apologize for misunderstanding. When you say the notice, you're referring to the order, the CBP letter?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, so the letter is unequivocal that if the defendant wants to...
But it references the election of proceedings form a number of times.
Yes, it does.
And the election of proceedings form appears to directly contradict the letter.
Well,
or it's hard to read the two consistently.
I agree with that, but even if that is true, the letter cannot contravene the language of the statute, which says that a remedy, a claim for relief must be filed by the date set forth in the letter, in this case, which is 35 days. And what the defense...
The government never raised the argument, right?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
The government did not raise the argument. The district court came up with the argument.
That's correct.
So even if all of that is so, isn't this a waivable affirmative defense rather than a jurisdictional bar?
Yes.
Well, then the government waived it.
Well, it's not that it's a that might have been imprecise in that what's clear is that the defendant is asking the court to read into the statute an equitable tolling. And a construction of the agreement that would permit tolling of the time limit that is...
The government never raised the argument. Unless it's jurisdictional, why should we adopt it?
Well, to this court can adopt any reasoning for affirming.
Well, I suppose that's true, but we also certainly hold defendants to waiving claims. So why shouldn't we hold the government to waiving claims? I mean, is this critical to your...
It's not critical, but nevertheless, because the government, we think we have strong arguments on each of the issues, but if the court prefers, we also feel that the defense's jurisdictional argument equally lacks merit for the reasons largely stated in this court's case in Aramay. There's no subject matter jurisdiction bar here when the amendment is made via Rule 36, and the record supports that this was an omission from the record or an oversight. First of all...
So you're jumping to the end. Well, why did it take the government so long to get the criminal indictment to the way, the criminal court?
Don't have a good answer for you, Your Honor.
Do you believe there's any period of time the government could wait that would require the rules to kick in that would not be a reasonable time, be an unreasonable delay, and therefore that the defendant would be entitled
So long as the indictment was still live, no. Because in this case, the sanction, the appropriate sanction for the government missing that 90-day deadline is an inability to proceed in the civil context. But
I understand that, but it, maybe I misunderstand the fact. There was civil forfeiture being begun by the government. There is no criminal indictment, right?
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor.
There was a criminal indictment prior, but there wasn't a forfeiture action pursuant to the criminal indictment?
Yes, Your Honor.
And in the indictment, was there a forfeiture count?
Yes.
Which all preceded?
Yes. Yes. And then once the defense moved to remit the property in the civil context, the government obtained warrants for the criminal forfeiture context. So,
what under 983A3B allows that kind of authorizes that?
Well, it's not authorized in 983. It's not authorized in
the
criminal court.
You just skip that language in 983 and go directly to the criminal court.
Well, so what 983A3C states is that if the government is not proceeding in the civil context, as it was not in this case, then the criminal forfeiture statute governs, which is Section 853 of 21 U.S.C. And that is the manner under which the government proceeded in this case. And what A3C...
Well, the government proceeded both.
That's true, Your Honor, but once
in
the...
And that second provision says if the criminal forfeiture is the only forfeiture proceeding commenced by the government.
The government did not commence a civil forfeiture.
And if the language, if the government does not file a complaint for forfeiture, it must do one or two things within the 90-day period. Must either return the property or obtain a criminal indictment, and you did neither?
That's correct.
And so the question is, what is the strategy? What do we do about that?
Right.
What's the sanction?
Exactly. And the government, our position is that the sanction is that the government can no longer proceed civilly against that property. But if there's probable cause to obtain warrants to seize property that's been identified in a forfeiture allegation in a criminal indictment, that is an entirely separate statutory scheme.
So it wouldn't matter how long the government...
Yes, and that is the district court decision I believe Your Honor was mentioning, was that the district court could find that the government had to remit that property, but, for instance, stay that order pending criminal forfeiture. But the district court also could not stay order and could order the government to remit the property, or, as counsel said, order the government potentially to pay interest on the funds that had been held beyond the 90-day deadline.
So you think there are remedies for on undue delay? The court could order you to pay interest. The government could order you to remit it right away.
It's possible, but none of those are present in this case. The defense raised none of those.
Well, certainly said he should have admitted it.
That's correct.
So it did raise. You just told me they didn't raise any of the claims.
That was too broad. I thought you were referring to the additional remedies. No, the remedy is a motion under, I believe it's Rule 41G, which is what they made. And in this case, that was effectively mooted by the obtaining of the criminal forfeiture warrants. And just to say one quick note about the amended language from previous version.
Are you going to address the argument 3?
Yes, Your Honor, that's what I'm referring to, the Rule 32.2 amendment. So under the amended version of Rule 32.2, which is that the court may correct an error at any time under Rule 36.
Clerical error.
Yes, Your Honor, and we submit that the error of the district court in this case in not entering the preliminary order before the judgment was, in fact, a clerical error. The record supports that for three reasons. First, at the 2010 hearing on the motion, the district court stated, quote, the omission of the preliminary order of forfeiture was an oversight. That's record 3384.
Well, okay, but he's making a legal determination of clerical error. And we don't refer to those. What's your second reason?
Well, second is that all parties were on notice in the December hearing in 2006 as to not only what property was eligible to be forfeited, but what the district court was going to order forfeited. the government had arrived at that hearing with a draft preliminary order of forfeiture, which the district court stated, the government's preliminary forfeiture order is fully supported by the evidence and the evidence presented to me at the November hearing. The defendants knew that that preliminary order of forfeiture was going to be entered against them. There was one minor issue to be corrected, which was the matter of joint and several liability. The district court instructed the government, get together with the defense, give me an amended order, and I will be
forfeited. Counsel, you agree that the criminal forfeiture is, that's a part of the sentence? That's part of the criminal sentence?
Yes.
All right. You can't have your cake and eat it too. When you made a mistake, you jumped out of the civil and said, well, it doesn't make any difference. Let's just argue. We'll just go to the criminal. But now you're in a more exacting area, criminal, aren't you? Because you're supposed to announce the sentence at the time of sentencing, which includes forfeiture. You didn't.
That's
true. And after 7 days, it becomes final unless you can show it really was a clerical error.
And in this case, the record reflects that it was a
No, it doesn't. What's the clerical error? Someone wrote down 7, it should be 6. There was categorically no mention at all of any preliminary forfeiture order. You can't, that's a categorical error. There was just no mention at all.
There was mention at the December hearing that...
No, that wasn't the sentencing. That wasn't the time of the order of sentencing when you announced the sentence.
The best reading of this record is that the district court likely intended to hold the judgment until the preliminary order of forfeiture. And that was the clerical error here, that the judgment was entered too early.
Then the effect of the 7 days would never have any impact because you could just say, well, you know, I must have forgotten the whole area of forfeiture. Well, the government didn't do anything. You didn't say anything to the district court.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think that, and the fact that the defense waited so long to object to this is evidence of the meeting of the minds of both the defense, the government, and the district court on this question, that it was very clear that this forfeiture order was going to be included as part of the sentence.
Well, did they appeal right away?
They did appeal right away. They filed an
objection. Did you argue that it was interlocutory?
No.
Well, then you thought it was final, too, then, without the forfeiture. It was final, correct?
Assuming that line of argument, there's then the forfeiture would have. Pardon me, Your Honor. There was no
forfeiture order at all. It was just the sentence, and it was final at that point.
Well, we'd submit that Rule 32.2 makes clear that Rule 36 can be used at any time.
But for clerical though, not for categorically. A whole different area. For example, let's say if you had a final order, say, and you said, I'm going to give you 10 years in prison or whatever, and then you come back and say, well, I'm also going to give restitution or something like that. Wouldn't that be a problem of the adding it to it?
Not under the Supreme Court's Dolan decision, which just came out, which admittedly was a case about restitution. But what the court there said was the longest the parties were on notice, the district court nonetheless retains the power to order restitution where, as here, the sentencing court makes clear prior to the deadline's expiration that it would order restitution. So too here.
Prior to
sentencing. And in this case, the district court had made clear that it was going to order for there is no reading of this record that the district court had not adequately notified the parties that it planned to order forfeiture in this case.
Go ahead. What about address the holding in Petrie?
Well, Your Honor, I think that courts have differed as to the degree to which Rule 36 can be used to correct these errors. Our position is that under the new wording of Rule 32.2, which admittedly was not enforced at the time the district court made its ruling, Rule 36 can be used at any time. And the question before this court, if it decides to consider this in light of Rule 32.2, is what was the effect of the amendment to Rule 32.2? If you look at the advisory committee notes accompanying the amendment to Rule 32.2, it states the amendment was intended to clarify what the district court is required to do. In that sense, there was not a substantive change intended between the previous version of Rule 32.2 and the current version of Rule 32.2. In other words, if you were to look at the current version of Rule 32.2, that operates as what the drafters of the rule intended the substance of the previous version to be. And under the new version, there's no question that Rule 36, contrary to Petrie, could be used in this case.
But what is the limit to clerical then? Nothing. If you can categorically amend it in an area such as forfeiture where no mention at all is the time of sentencing, what limit is there in qualifying to clerical error? You're reading clerical out of there. It's basically error, isn't it?
Well, Rule 36 says clerical error or an omission in the record, and it is reserved to this court to determine whether that was an appropriate use of Rule 36. But as the Fourth Circuit noted in an unpublished case, the Powell decision, which was not cited in our briefs, 266 F Appendix 263, the Fourth Circuit there noted that Rule 36 has been used in the forfeiture context. So where the
context was it used?
To correct an errantly omitted preliminary forfeiture order from a sentence, or excuse me, final forfeiture from a sentence. So, apologies.
No, please finish your answer.
My thought is that the natural limit is that this court has to determine that Rule 36 was appropriate to use. And we submit that in this case it was, because the record makes clear that the district court intended the preliminary order to accompany the sentence. If that is not clear from the record, then Rule 36 would not be appropriate to use.
The new 32.2 just makes it clear that the most significant feature is notice, that the court has to include the forfeiture when orally announcing the sentence or otherwise ensure that the defendant knows about it. And there's no argument that notice is complied.
Agreed.
No, I'm stating that. I mean, I don't believe that there is an objection that the parties were not on notice of the forfeiture from the court's statement.
That was my understanding from Mr. Biddle's position.
Can you just help me a little bit with the chronology here?
Yes.
On December 19, 2006, we have a sentencing hearing.
Yes.
And at the sentencing hearing, do we have discussion of the preliminary order of forfeiture?
No.
When do we have discussion of the preliminary order of forfeiture?
That preceded the sentencing. It was
before
a hearing. That's right, Your Honor. And then the defendants were sentenced individually, so there was a separate sentencing.
So do we know how much before the preliminary order of forfeiture?
It was December. From my notes here, I don't have it, Your
in
Honor.
December.
It was in December. Yes, Your Honor. There was a November 21st hearing in which all the evidence came in, and then there was a December hearing. I want to say it was the 13th. I don't have it.
Okay, so the preliminary order of forfeiture discussed in both of those times.
Most germanely in the latter hearing in December, the former was more presentation of the evidence.
And is it at that time where the district court says, I'm going to enter this preliminary order of forfeiture, which really is final with respect to these people, but not third parties?
The district court did not say it as unequivocally as you just put it. What the district court said was, the order that the government had submitted on that day, the preliminary order of forfeiture, is fully supported by the evidence. There was one issue that the parties had contested, which was the matter of joint and several liability.
Right.
The court asked the government to draft a new one to get together with the defense, and then the court said he'd be glad to enter.
That's pretty good. Okay, so you have that happening around December 12th, 13th, prior to the sentence.
That's
which
correct.
We have no discussion of court.
That's right.
And then on January 19, 2007, about a month later, we have the preliminary order of forfeiture entered.
That's right.
Which is an order that the defense has signed on to in response to the government. To this court, they've worked out the joint several liability.
That's right.
Then in April 2010, we have the government, we have the defense objecting. Is that right?
That's correct. 38 months later.
Okay. And their argument is that the sentence that was issued on December 19, 2006 should have included this preliminary order of forfeiture.
That is how I understand it.
And that you would acknowledge that's correct. True.
Absolutely, Your Honor. It should have.
And you say that it's a...
It's an error cognizable under Rule 36, which is an omission in the record or a clerical error.
Clerical error. Like Judge Gregory, it doesn't sound like what we think of as a clerical error, you know? And you probably would acknowledge that.
I understand. There's a if there's a way that people use the phrase
there's
clerical
no
error, there's
problem.
Exactly.
It's yes. not typographical.
That's right. It's not. But
so what you do, though, is rely on this change in the rule, and most particularly in the commentary accompanying the rule.
That's correct, Your Honor. In addition to cases from every circuit but the 11th Circuit, which stands for the proposition that Rule 36 can be used.
That the clerical error includes something like this.
That's right. When
it seemed to me that those cases were distinguishable.
They are distinguishable largely for the reason that the preliminary forfeiture order had been entered prior to sentencing, but it wasn't ultimately entered with the judgment. So in this case, we would submit that there is no meaningful difference between the preliminary order of forfeiture and having entered before the judgment in this case. The defense was 100% on notice as to what it would contain, and indeed, their delay in objecting makes that clear.
Who could the government have waited 3 years?
Could the court have waited?
I assume that the court. Are you representing to us that you have presented this to the court? The court had just refused to enter the order?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
It seems to me the record suggests that the government didn't get the order to the court until January. Am I misreading the record?
I'm not sure that the record shows that necessarily, but it's not. We're not putting this on the district court. So the government should have gotten that order to the district court the next day is the short answer to your question. So to the extent that there is a limitation on it, it again returns to when you can use Rule 36, because the language of Rule 36 says at any time.
I don't understand. The government comes in. I recall in the Fourth Circuit there was a case where I think it was a collateral review in a death case where they had missed by, I think, about one day a time statute in terms of we said no, it was not equitable tolling, and the person was executed.
Indeed.
Yeah.
But, I remember it well.
Yeah, indeed, the case. But here, the government just sort of, you start out with, I delayed on the civil side. Well, then I'll go to the criminal side. Then you go on the criminal side, and you don't do that right, and then we're supposed to say that's clerical. At some point, isn't the government responsible for particularly in the areas of criminal area, that's the sentence. It's the sentence. In those cases, there was an order entered. Here, there was no order entered.
I understand your position, Your Honor, but the government also urged the court to consider the broader equities here, which is that this error would constitute a windfall for the defense. There is no dispute that this property was appropriately forfeited. There's no substantive dispute. It would be the inability of the district court to use Rule 36 would constitute the defense.
Well, just as it does in terms of our great framers, that whenever there's a violation, there's a windfall in terms of Fourth Amendment, in terms of the protection of government being overreaching is worth that risk. And here, a criminal case, and you don't have the order, and then you can just call it clerical, that opens the door for a lot of things to be clerical when categorically there's no order.
Your Honor, I'd like to respond, but I see that my time is expired. Only in circumstances where the record is clear that all parties knew a preliminary order was going to be entered. Not in any case. Not Rule 36 cannot be used preciously. Only when the record supports it, as it does in this case. I thank you for it.
Thank you.
I want to get back to Judge Duncan's question to me, and also she put it to the government, as to whether the defense had notice at sentencing of the forfeiture. There are two parts of Rule 32.2 as amended that address notice. 32.2a provides notice of the possibility of forfeiture has to be provided in the indictment. And I do agree with the court that the possibility of forfeiture was known to the defense at sentencing. But for the purposes of Rule 32.2b, 3b, notice and inclusion of the judgment, the new rule says that the court must otherwise ensure that the defendant knows of the forfeiture at sentencing. Now, that language would be surplusage if the indictment alone was enough. So we contend.
We have a hearing in November 21st, earlier in December.
Right. That
so the government, you or your predecessor were present at that hearing.
Correct.
Right?
And again, the possibility, courts will say a lot of things and change their mind. The court had not entered the order at that point. And we contend that the language in the rule as revised refers to the knowledge of entry of the order, not the possibility of forfeiture, but that the defendant needs to know the forfeiture order has been entered. That's why Mr. Casella, whose treatise is addressed in the government's brief, says that the current fix, the revision to Rule 32.2, does not fix the problem before this court. Pages 49 and 50 of the government's brief says the 32.2 fixes all of those cases where the preliminary order of forfeiture is entered before sentencing. On those facts, you can go back later, quote, at any time, and revise your judgment and commitment order to include a timely entered preliminary order of forfeiture. What the government's trying to do here is to put the cart before the horse and say, you can use this provision to amend as a clerical error a judgment and commitment order to include an order that hadn't even been entered at the time of sentencing.
And is it your position that the district court didn't have jurisdiction to do?
It did not have the authority, and I apologize for not. We challenged the jurisdictional basis and the court's ability as a matter of the subject matter of sentencing under the rules to amend retroactively the judgment and commitment order where the preliminary order of forfeiture was not entered before.
I understand that. I'm asking
and,
you with that group.
Yes.
Say the district court had no jurisdiction.
Yes. And Mr.
And is the answer to that question yes?
Yes, Your Honor. And Mr.
Okay, then I think you're going to have to, you have an uphill battle, it seems to me, distinguishing those. I understand, believe me, I understand it deals with restitution and not forfeiture. But in taking that into, we very seldom have a case that's exactly responsible.
I understand. Dolan's up. It's a narrow decision. There was a strong dissent in there. And the court is not inviting, I think the Supreme Court is not inviting courts to continue to bifurcate, trifurcate sentencing.
No, I don't. I think you're right about that. But this Dolan is part of a series of cases in which the Supreme Court has decided that things are not jurisdictional. Previously
right.
Thought were jurisdictional are not jurisdictional. And that's why this would be out of line with that, if we would suddenly find that this is a jurisdictional problem.
With all due respect to the court, again, in Dolan, actually, the judgment referenced restitution. Okay? The judgment in Dolan said the court is ordering restitution. The amount is to be determined later. That's a fundamental jurisdictional difference between this case and Dolan.
So you're putting your eggs in it.
Yes, Ron.
Yeah, because if it's not jurisdictional, then under these facts, you're left with plain errors. Even if you were right about error, you had to be plain error because you didn't object.
Well, we did object. We filed a notice of appeal immediately.
You did? Right after,
the
January 19th when the preliminary order was entered?
No, Your Honor.
That's what I'm saying. You didn't object to it.
We objected to the judgment and commitment order. In fact, the preliminary order of forfeiture is not an appealable order. Okay? A defendant, normally the preliminary order of forfeiture is filed sometimes months or weeks before sentencing. A defendant can't appeal from that. He can only appeal from the judgment and commitment. So we filed two appeals here. We filed an appeal immediately after the judgment and commitment was filed without reference to the preliminary order of forfeiture. And then years later, when the court retroactively amended it, purportedly due to clerical error, we filed another timely notice of appeal. So we complied with our obligations under the rules as to what is an appealable order to the court.
You mean
court.
You couldn't appeal it until the court amended it?
Well, the preliminary order of forfeiture is not a final appealable order. It's described as a preliminary order of forfeiture.
So it seems to me this undercuts the argument that, I'm not sure you.
I don't think you helped yourself.
Well, what I'm trying to say is that Judge Duncan had expressed concern about whether we had preserved our objections. And when the court filed a judgment and commitment order without any reference to forfeiture at all, but still held on to the defendant's funds, timely notice of appeal was filed. Then when years later the preliminary order is included in an appealable order, that is to say a judgment and commitment order, then the defendants filed their notice of appeal.
You're overlooking our little diagram. I didn't think it was in dispute. We have discussion of forfeiture in November and early December.
Correct.
We have the sentence issued in November 19th.
Correct.
We have the preliminary order of forfeiture issued January 19th, have your objection in April 2010.
Correct.
And if you maintain that that's timely?
Well, first of all, the government didn't object at any point. The court raised waiver earlier. At no point has the government contended that either of our appeals were untimely to preserve the forfeiture issue. In fact, in their brief, they put in a footnote. They conceded this particular point on the timeliness.
Well, the government had no skin in the game because they had your property.
The footnote one of their brief actually addresses Judge Motz's concern, which is, either way, it says, otherwise, the validity of the orders of forfeiture is properly before the court in the present appeals. And
I'm not sure that's proceeding.
Well,
I think that goes back to their response to the Gregory's series of questions, not to this, but go ahead.
I'll sit down just to say that, again, this is not an off-the-wall position on the jurisdictional problem. Mr. Casello, deputy chief of forfeiture, his treatise is cited in the government's brief, and he pinpoints this exact situation before the court being problematic. We've got Petrie, we've got Crutcher, and we've got King, all published decisions, which if the court follows their analysis, reasoning, and the facts in those cases, the court should find that the court was without authority and jurisdiction to order forfeiture in this case. Thank you.
Okay.
So I understand you're court appointed?
No, I'm not actually, Your Honor. I'm court appointed. I substituted.
Did some of your colleagues, or some of your colleagues, did anybody court appointed?
That was the third case.
Yeah.
I'm sorry that I got to thank you for your service to the court. It's been very much appreciated. And I should have done it, but I'm glad you're still important. We'll come down and greet the lawyers. First, ask the court to return to court today.
Of course, I'm going to learn more about the matter.